you for tuning in to today's edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report here on this Friday. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. On today's show, Taylor Charlstrom will be in to talk about the issue of weeds in irrigation canals, and Vicki Boyd will be in to report on the recent finding of an Asian citrus psyllid infected with a citrus greening bacterium in a San Diego County commercial citrus orchard. And I'll have a look at national and regional agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture is now accepting a second round of public comment on a draft request for grant application for the Sustainable California Grown Cannabis Pilot Study. Comments will be accepted through August 5th at 5 p.m. Late submissions will not be accepted. The draft RGA is available for review and public comment on the California Department of Food and Agriculture website. CDFA will hold a workshop to provide information on a draft RGA and discuss changes made to the original draft. Participants may attend at no cost by registering for webinar access. The webinar will take place on Thursday, July 28th from 10 a.m. until noon. One of the goals of regulating cannabis in California is to assess potential environmental benefits that may be associated with cultivation. Greenhouse gas emission reduction, sustainable land use and soil health benefits are some of these. The SCGC pilot study will fund projects to collect data from the industry to determine best management practices for outdoor cannabis cultivation. Funds will be awarded through a competitive grant process and distributed to not-for-profits, academic institutions, resource conservation districts, federal and California recognized Native American Indian tribes, and local cultivator organizations in collaboration with California entities eligible for the pilot study. CDFA encourages applications from organizations that serve small to medium-sized and socially disadvantaged California food producers and farm workers. CDFA released the initial draft RGA on March 14th. On April 12th, they hosted an informational workshop to provide an overview of program guidelines and application materials. The webinar also provided an opportunity for the public to provide comments on the draft application materials. Written comments on the draft RGA were submitted to the department on April 14th. Researchers at the University of California, Davis are working to breed new varieties of a popular leafy green vegetable in Asian cuisine that may be grown in warmer climates. Celtus, or stem lettuce, is grown for its crunchy stalk, which has a mild nutty taste. Celtus plants generally thrive in cool climates, but a new garden at UC Davis and Greenhouse Cultivations are testing different breeds in hopes they can thrive in hotter temperatures. Researchers say the breeding program could be expanded to other crops. Recognizing a high growth potential for exports to the Philippines, United States representatives, agribusinesses, and farm organizations will travel to the country this month. Daniel Whitley, Foreign Agricultural Service Administrator, and traveling participants will attend a USDA-sponsored trade mission where they will engage with potential buyers, receive in-depth market briefs, and visit sites. He says the Philippines is an excellent market for U.S. farm and food products, and they look forward to introducing a diverse group of companies and organizations to new export opportunities there. U.S. brands sell very well in the Philippines, where consumers regard products as safe, reliable, and of good quality. The United States has enjoyed a long and prosperous trading relationship with the Philippines, and the mission is an ideal opportunity to expand exports further there. The Philippines is currently the eighth most significant market for agricultural exports from the United States. Consequently, the U.S. is also responsible for 21% of the import market share to the Philippines. Exports from the United States to the Philippines accounted for $3.5 billion in 2021. Of the top three commodities exported to the Philippines in 2021 was dairy products. They accounted for $322 million. The Philippines is the 12th most populated country in the world, with nearly 115 million people living in the country. Officials from California that will be attending a trade mission include members of the California Blueberry Commission from Clovis, the California California Milk Advisory Board of Tracy. There will be representation from MEM Fairway Incorporated of Irvine, as well as Redwood International, also of Irvine. A few days ago here in the My Ag Life Daily News Report, I had this information, but I thought it bears worth repeating. A portion of Los Angeles County has been placed under quarantine for the oriental fruit fly following the detection of 14 flies in the North Hills area of the San Fernando Valley. The quarantine zone measures 89 square miles, bordered on the north by the Angeles National Forest, on the south by the Ventura Freeway, on the west by Porter Ranch, and on the east by Hanson Dam Park. The quarantine map can be found on the California Department of Food and Agriculture website. And USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekinowski is in with a short outlook at the global outlook for rice.
Tighter global supplies, total use down globally this month, but still a record. Supplies are still relatively abundant, although at the global level, ending stocks for the new crop year forecast to reach a three-year low. Still pretty abundant given, the ending stocks forecast level of 182.8 million tons.
Once again, that is USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekinowski.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
Taylor Charlstrom is in with a report now on weeds in irrigation canals.
When growers think about weeds and weed control, they're usually thinking in the context of the land on their own operations. But weeds are resilient and adaptive, and they can grow almost anywhere, including in irrigation canals. All they need is a shallow body of water, some sediment, and some sunlight, and they'll take off. Unlike the weed problems of the California Delta and many large lakes, the weeds in irrigation ditches are almost entirely native species. Filamentous attached algae can also contribute to nuisance weed growth. USDA research biologist John Madsen notes the negative effects of having weeds take over a canal and why this can be damaging to the grower.
It reduces the amount of water that can be delivered. So if your canal is chock full of weeds, you're only going to get about a half or a quarter of the water delivered that you want to get. The water slows. And as it slows, what it also does is it deposits any sediment that's in that canal. So it just compounds the problem. It creates an additional maintenance problem as well as creating better habitat for weeds. The second thing is as it fills, you can actually cause flooding. Well, that's not good. You don't want to flood adjacent fields because there are weeds in your irrigation canal. Now, I've predominantly worked on lakes, reservoirs, and rivers across the country. And there, our weed problems are typically non-native plants that have been introduced to this country, and they see an available space and they take it. But in irrigation canals, all of our weeds to speak of are native plants. They were already here. But what you're doing with the irrigation canal for those weeds is you're creating a nice wet spot that has plenty of water, and they're typically fairly clear, so there's plenty of sunlight. Well, if you have some sunlight available to plants and some substrate, they will grow, and they will grow quite well. So it's not like we've created necessarily a problem. It's just that our plants that are already here are taking advantage of a kind of a new habitat, a new site. But that defeats the purpose of having that irrigation canal, okay, which is to deliver water to farmers. And the canals that are most at risk are the smaller canals, the feeder canals that bring water to individual areas, individual fields, not the main stem canal itself that carries the bulk of the water. The third thing that happens, I should point out, is as the weeds grow, eventually they get to be so much that they dislodge from the bottom and drift down. And when that happens, if there's any structure in the canal at all, like a bridge or a gate or whatever, they'll lodge up against that and create a dam. So that can really slow the delivery of water below that point.
The weeds that form in canals and replicate themselves typically form by stem fragments instead of seeds, so the concern of water transporting seeds to other operations is unlikely. Another thing is the difference in management of canal weeds compared to weeds on an ag operation. The opportunities for management are much less.
They're not fish habitat, despite what some people in some states think. They're industrial. They're made to deliver water. They're a pipe with the top taken off so you can maintain it, right? So you're managing a structure that's made for a specific purpose. It's not a natural habitat. That makes them different in terms of management. You can do things managing there that you can't do at other sites. The second thing, of course, is that water is desperately needed for agriculture, okay? And in other sites, you can manage just some of the weeds, or you can ignore the weeds if you really wish to. It's a very different situation. Managing the weeds in the irrigation canal is a must-do proposition. And of course, the third thing is that water is being used to water crops. So what you can do is severely restricted from that perspective. You know, for instance, if you're using an herbicide, there's a very small number of herbicides that are approved for use in irrigation canals. Is because those are the least toxic? Well, actually not. The one of the most commonly used herbicides for canals is a product that's known as acrolein, and it is carried into the canal in a nitrogen gas stream, and then it bubbles off. But it is really a biocide. I mean, it kills plants like crazy, and it kills them for some distance down from the injection site. But it's very toxic to people. But just while you're using it, just while you're injecting it, and once it gets in the atmosphere, it dissipates and there's no ill effect. It's also toxic to fish. So there are very strict rules on what you have to do if that irrigation water eventually ends up in a natural water. The second thing is whatever you use has very strict rules about the potential to be taken up into food crops or animals if you're irrigating pasture or hay. All those things have to be tested at the strictest standard in terms of how toxic is the material in the plants to be used for feed or fodder. And that testing, needless to say, is expensive. So a lot of companies just don't bother. They don't want to go there. So that leaves us with a very small pool of herbicides that can be used in the water, and then a few additional that you can use on the ditch banks, glyphosate being the most common.
Like weed management in a field or orchard, management in canals is also integrated. It's not just chemical methods that are being used, especially with the fact that chemical methods are extremely limited in canals as to not infiltrate the water supply.
Physical control options that are available is while there's water in the canal, you can chain. And that's originally what you did was you had two tractors and you put a big heavy chain across and connected them so that as you drove the tractors, it would drag the bottom and pull up the weeds. But of course, all those weeds then drift down to the next structure. So you have to have somebody pulling those weeds out. Some people also have what looks like a big fork on a vehicle. And they reach down, they pull it up, or it might be a scoop. But chaining now, there have been a lot of innovations to chaining, most of them locally made by the individual irrigation district. For instance, I think the picture I used in the blog I posted shows something made by an irrigation district near, in Tulare, California. And they have a chain suspended from a big bar. And so one vehicle can tug that through the canal and pull up weeds. And, you know, the main drawback with that is that, it's heavy equipment. You got to operate it. You have to have another piece of equipment pulling weeds out so it doesn't plug structures. So any control you get is just where you actually drag that chain. Often what they'll try is that all these irrigation canals typically are not wet all year long. They release water when the irrigation water is needed, and it continues until cropping is done for the year or whatever the case may be. And so they then let those canals go dry. They turn off the water spigot to that canal. When that happens, some districts will use a shovel to, big mechanical shovel to pull the mud that's accumulated off the bottom and pull out the weeds and try and remove enough that they get whatever plant propagule is left. But that is also a fairly slow and expensive proposition. So those are the two or three main approaches that are used. And really, when you look at it, all those approaches are used together. So most districts use some sort of herbicide to control their weed and algae problems at some point in time. In California is no different. They use the irrigation districts use a lot of different herbicides. There are more restrictions on what they can use and when and how much monitoring they have to do. But then, after all, it is California.
Future projects putting solar panels over canals to reduce the evaporation of water from said canals might also have an effect on the way weeds grow. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
The Department of Agriculture has announced more than $14 billion in agricultural workforce training for underserved communities. USDA says the funding will increase the resilience of the U.S. meat and poultry processing sector. The investment is part of the American Rescue Plan to strengthen the nation's food supply chain by promoting fair and competitive agricultural markets. Funding is available through the USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture's request for applications process to eligible universities. Eligible applicants include qualified centers of excellence at 1890 land-grant universities, 1994 land-grant tribal colleges, Hispanic-serving institutions, Alaska Native and Native Hawaiian institutions, and participants in the Resident Instruction Grants Program for institutions of higher education in insular areas. Dr. Shavonda Jacobs-Young, USDA Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics, who also serves as USDA Chief Scientist, says these investments provide critical support to higher education partners to increase rural prosperity and economic sustainability of food systems in underserved agricultural communities. In fiscal year 2021, the value of U.S. fruit imports and vegetable imports rose to a record level. The record is projected to rise another 9% in FY 2022 to $42.6 billion, according to USDA's Economic Research Service. Import volumes are also expected to grow 3% in 2022 to 29.4 million metric tons. This would further extend the trend seen from 2000 to 2021, during which the volume of U.S. fruit and vegetable imports increased 124%. While the inflation-adjusted value of those imports increased 208%. The shift indicates that on a per-volume basis, imported fruits and vegetable products are priced higher than they were 20 years ago, as growth in the value of these imports has exceeded growth in volume. Steadily increasing unit prices for imported fresh fruits and vegetables, up from $753 per metric ton in 2000 to $1,192 in 2021, have contributed significantly to the observed trend. Renowned public policy analyst Bruce Melman will serve as the keynote speaker for the National Grocer Association's Executive Conference and Public Policy Summit, the premier event for C-suite executives and their leadership teams. Respected food safety attorney Bill Marler also joins the speaker lineup to address attendees on improved safety procedures and recall communications. The Executive Conference and Public Policy Summit is scheduled for October 24th through the 26th in Washington, D.C. As keynote speaker, Melman will offer summit attendees insight into the shifting political landscape leading up to the 2022 midterm elections and the potential impact on businesses in the United States. And in his session, Marler will discuss his pioneering casework representing plaintiffs impacted by contaminated food products and offer his thoughts on how food companies can do a better job enacting food safety procedures and communicating recalls to consumers. Two Democrats have introduced the Food Safety Administration Act to establish a Food Safety Administration. The administration would be a single food safety agency responsible for keeping a food safe for market. Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLauro introduced the legislation with Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. The Food Safety Administration Act would establish a Food Safety Administration under the Department of Health and Human Services by incorporating the existing food programs within the Food and Drug Administration into a separate agency, the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, Center for Veterinary Medicine, and the Office of Regulatory Affairs. Representative DeLauro says, look no further than the recent infant formula crisis to understand the need to create a single food safety agency led by a food policy expert to ensure the safety of products that go to market. The legislation is endorsed by the Center for Food Safety, Consumer Reports, Environmental Working Group, Friends of the Earth, and others. Small businesses, including most family farms that file taxes as individuals, would take a hit from a tax hike that President Biden is considering to fund a resurrected Build Back Better spending bill, that from GOP lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell argued against the White House raising taxes on family farms and other small businesses to fund a renewed Build Back Better bill when record inflation could drive the economy into a tailspin.
And now they want to pour fuel on the flames by making it more likely that we go into a recession by raising taxes on all of these businesses, the vast majority of businesses in America, which will only cause them to reduce the number of employees.
McConnell is threatening to pull support for technology competition bills covering computer chips already mired in a House-Senate fight unless the White House relents on Build Back Better. President Biden is again negotiating with West Virginia's Joe Manchin to help win the 50 Senate votes needed, plus the tie-breaking vote of the vice president to secure a pre-election win. But Farm State Republicans, including Iowa's Joni Ernst, argue a tax hike now is a bad idea.
At a time when they are facing increased input costs like fertilizer, just as an example, diesel fuel. It is very detrimental and it could be extremely impactful in a negative way to those small family farms.
Ernst says many not in farming don't understand producers' plight.
But what they don't recognize is that cost of diesel this spring to get into the fields and the cost of fertilizer has really hamstrung a lot of these farmers, and they're just not seeing any margins increasing even though commodities are up.
And those prices could come down soon. New inflation numbers at over 9% prompting more big interest rate hikes by the Fed, plus a cratering of the euro against the dollar raising U.S. grain export prices are now all adding to fears of a recession.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Vicki Boyd joins us next. She reports on a recent finding of an Asian citrus psyllid infected with the citrus greening bacterium in a San Diego County commercial citrus orchard.
For only the second time in California, an Asian citrus psyllid found in a commercial citrus orchard has tested positive for the bacterium that causes citrus greening. The disease also is known as Wanglong Bing, or HLB. It is harmless to humans, but it can decimate citrus trees. In Florida, it has caused commercial citrus production to drop by 80%. The latest find was from a citrus orchard in the Palmer Valley area of San Diego County, but it does not necessarily mean trees in the orchard are infected with HLB. So far, HLB infections in California have been limited to scattered residential citrus trees in the southern part of the state. How the citrus psyllid picked up the bacterium is unknown, said Sandeepa Gautam, a UC Cooperative Extension IPM advisor for Kern, Tulare, Fresno, and Madera counties.
Asian citrus psyllid is an insect that feeds on plant sap, and while it's doing that, it injects its saliva into the plant and also takes up the plant sap. If it's feeding in an area where the bacterium is present, it takes up the bacterium along with the plant sap while it's feeding, and that bacterium goes and multiplies in the insect body and it stays there throughout its life. So a CLAS positive Asian citrus psyllid would mean that that psyllid had fed on a Wanglong Bing positive tree somewhere and was flying to another area where it was when it was caught on a trap.
Nevertheless, Gautam said the positive psyllid is cause for concern. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is surveying the San Diego County area in which the psyllid was found to determine the extent of the infestation.
It is concerning to the whole California citrus industry. To my knowledge, they haven't found any HLB positive trees in San Diego in commercial citrus. It was just the Asian citrus psyllid. It could have been a psyllid that was flying from a nearby residential area where they have a HLB positive tree. It's hard to say where it is, where it came from, but that also means that we need to be vigilant and sample the nearby areas for any HLB positive tree from where the psyllid was caught. And I believe that California Department of Food and Agriculture is doing the survey as we talk.
Gautam praised growers, pest control advisors, and the entire citrus industry for stepping up to manage the psyllid, which is a known HLB vector. It's been almost 10 years since the disease was found in a residential citrus tree in Los Angeles, and it is yet to turn up in a commercial citrus orchard in the state. But she encouraged the industry to remain vigilant.
It's been almost 10 years that the disease was found, and to date, it hasn't made it to commercial citrus growers yet. That being said, I think because the major way that disease moves is by vector movement, being extra vigilant on Asian citrus psyllid mitigation steps and following the regulatory practices and following UCIPM guidelines, treatment schedules developed by researchers to control Asian citrus psyllid in different regions is the main way to mitigate it and limit the spread of the disease into commercial orchards. As for San Joaquin Valley, there are regulations in place, CDFA regulations, UCIPM recommendations, and based on, you know, where the ACP populations are currently found, there are different zones established on how fruit can, what needs to be done for moving fruit and plant material from one quarantine zone to another. So staying current in those regulations and following the steps set by CDFA and UCIPM guidelines is what we need to be doing.
The positive find also should prompt growers and PCAs to revisit what the psyllid looks like and how to scout for it in an orchard. If you should find psyllid, Gautam recommended contacting the local county regional grower liaison.
I just want to bring it up that there have been recent finds in Visalia and in Lemon Cove active established populations of Asian citrus psyllid, which now have been treated with insecticides. But that brings up to us being more vigilant in ACP mitigation and keeping an eye out and knowing how to look for Asian citrus psyllid, just refreshing our knowledge on how the pest looks like, how to monitor it while you are out in the field. There are two active ways to monitor for ACP. One is called tap sampling, where you take a mallet or a stick and just tap on the branches that about mid-height of the tree and watch what falls out and identify ACP. Another way to do it, especially during the new flush, is because Asian citrus psyllid adults would only lay eggs on new flush during the flush time, which is going to be in several weeks here. Going out and watching the flush and looking for eggs or nymph population is another way to monitor for ACP. And if you find ACP in your grove, then contact grower liaison in your area as soon as possible, reach out to the county directors and county office in your area and let people know about your findings.
Although yellow sticky traps can pick up citrus psyllid, she called them passive monitoring because they catch anything that flies into them. CDFA is currently using those traps to monitor different regions, but she said they shouldn't replace active scouting.
There are no traps specific for ACP because there is no lure. Any sticky trap would help monitor for ACP during the season. You can call it passive sampling. You put a trap out there, and if anything flies, that's caught in the trap. That is what CDFA is doing throughout the area. CDFA has what they call regulatory traps throughout the citrus growing regions here, and they come out and replace those traps every 2 weeks, I believe. And if psyllids are found on a trap, then they scout that area for any live populations. That's how the Lemon Cove populations were found.
The Lemon Cove citrus psyllid find Gautam mentioned is only about 10 miles from UC's Lynn Cove Citrus Research and Extension Center, where she is based. Workers continue to scout the station, which is home to more than 30 active citrus research projects. So far, she said, they have not found the pest. For more information on HLB, citrus psyllid, or current quarantines and regulations, visit the Citrus Pest and Disease Prevention Program's website at citrusinsider.org. This is Vicki Boyd, reporting for My Ag Life.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.